Today is February 1, 2018. This is a Grand Canyon oral history. We're at the home of Guy Williams, regular spelling, G-U-I-W-I-L-L-I-A-M-S. And my name is Tom Martin here in Flagstaff, Arizona. And Guy was on a Glen Canyon river trip in the late 1950s, early 1960s. With Catherine Bartlett, B-A-R-T-L-E-T-T, and Jean Foster, G-E-N-E-F-O-S-T-E-R. Guy, where were you born?
I was born in Phoenix.
What year?
1946.
And what were your folks, were they living here in Flagstaff at the time?
Yes, they were.
What were they doing here?
My dad was the music department for Flagstaff Public Schools, primarily the high school band, high school choir, all girls drum and bugle corps. He basically had the music department under him.
You mentioned the other day we were talking about your earliest recollections of Flagstaff, and one of those was the Zanzuki cream wagon?
The milk wagon,
the milk wagon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, can you tell me about that?
Well, we lived on Humphreys at Sullivan, and Frank Zanzuki had the dairy at that time, and he had a horse-drawn milk wagon. And I used to run up to the corner of Fort Valley and Humphreys and catch the milk wagon in the morning when he was out delivering milk. I was probably about 3, maybe 4. And I would ride down, basically it was like 2 blocks, because it was just through, the neighborhood that we lived in. That was the big thrill. I didn't do it every day, but I did it quite often.
What are some of your other earlier memories of Flagstaff as a child?
Well, probably the most impressional memory that I have was kindergarten. I had Mrs. Tinsley, as did a lot of people, T-I-N-S-L-E-Y. Miss Tinsley was, a very definite Southern lady, and she and my mother got along very well because my mother was from Alabama, so... they would get together, and Mrs. Tinsley still had her very severe accent, Mrs. Tinsley actually taught us more of what would be at that time, which would have been considered like first and second grade stuff. So she really got us advanced. Her husband was he was a professor over at the university, and it was a very educational family. And the nice thing about Mrs. Tinsley was the fact that anytime anybody would come back to Flagstaff, to visit or anything like that, we always ended up in Mrs. Tinsley's backyard with lemonade and cookies. Huh. And it didn't matter how old you were, it was always Mrs. Tinsley. She was just, very, very highly thought of.
Nice. Huh. So I'm trying to think about Flagstaff in 1950, 1951, 52. Today, Highway 180 runs runs up toward the Grand Canyon over to mm-hmm. Valley. Back then, was there a dirt road connecting over to Valley? Or?
Yes.
Okay. So if you wanted to go to the Grand Canyon, you could just head out of town right here,
yeah.
out Fort Valley Road, and go that way.
Right.
What else do you remember about? I know someone talked about the train the other day coming through town. Do you remember the steam trains coming through?
Oh yeah, yeah, and you know that was the you know the nice thing you could hear them. Well, all over what was town at that time. you know, you could hear them. You know, when the whistle would blow, and it was really kind of a nice sound. I mean, it was kind of a kind of freedom. You know, was there, and you know, and also during those years, we also had the noon whistle from downtown. Every noon, it whistled. That it was 12 o'clock, and I don't know why we had it or anything like that, but...
Do you think that was the lumber mill?
No, it was downtown.
Really?
Yeah, okay. it was on top of the old police station,
huh.
which was at Beaver and Birch. It was the southeast corner of Beaver and Birch. You know, that was the police station. That was the city jail. It was all in that building. And it kind of surprised me that. When they did move it, you know, when they moved it over over on Sawmill, that just, because of the size of the building, of course, they had to do that. Also remember in, it was in 1964, because the college was growing and, you know, the 60s were upon us, the police department invited, somebody from the, I'm not sure it was the DEA at that time, but it was a drug enforcement individual to come in and talk to the city police. And as he was leaving the building one day, he looked into the garden right in the in front of the police station, and there were several nice plants of marijuana growing right in front of the police station. Nobody knew what they were, but they were pretty plants.
Oh my gosh.
Those, of course, were taken out right away.
Did you camp out much as a child? Did your parents travel much? Did they camp much? Or
they didn't camp. I did a lot of camping. My dad, being a teacher, during the summer he worked as a seasonal ranger at Zion.
Wow.
And I started out. You know, we actually had a cabin in the Grotto campground. It had been a small museum, and they had changed it into a ranger's quarters. And so I started out camping right across the street from the house, and then each summer that we were there, I got farther and farther away. It would be when I was... I guess I was 11 or 12. I started, at the far end of the Grotto Campground was a group campsite. And there would always be troops of Boy Scouts coming through there. And so I would go over there. And when I was a Boy Scout, most of the merit badges that I earned were signed by counsels other than my own counsel, because I would work with them on merit badges. And so I'd get a merit badge counselor from, you know, from Minnesota, or a merit badge counselor from Washington State, or, you know, wherever. And so my merit badges were from all over the place. You know, so I did that, and then probably when I, well, I guess I was probably 14, 15, I started, probably two or three times a summer, I would go up to Lava Point, which was in Zion Monument, which is now Zion Backcountry. I would work with the fire lookouts, and you know, we'd watch out for, you know, for any fires in the backcountry back there. When I was 16, I actually spent a month there at Lava Point as the secondary lookout. So oftentimes the main lookout, the paid lookout, you know, would have to run an errand, or we would have to check something, and so I was observing area for, you know, for 2-3 hours by myself, you know, watching for fire. Never saw any, but you know, that's a good thing. when I would get through at Lava Point, I would ride up with the crew. They would generally come down on Saturday or Sunday, pick up food and so forth to take back up. So I would ride up with them. But then when I was through, I would actually hike down the to the grotto. Which was right off of the Angel Landing Trail, so I would, you know, I would hike down from there, and it was probably about a 10-15 mile hike, of course I'd have to, you know, carry my sleeping bag and so forth on my back, really, you know, I really got to go around Zion quite a bit, know Zion pretty much like the back of my hand, much like I, you know, here in Flagstaff, I would work with my granddad in his saddle shop, and I would also, you know, with friends around here, I would, you know, we'd do a lot of hiking and camping right here in the Flagstaff area. You know, we did Humphreys, I don't know how many times. The ruins over on Mount Eldon. We did that a bunch. We did a lot of hiking and a lot of camping. Of course, at that time there were no real restrictions on where you camped, because once you got out of the city, you were in National Forest, and so we just camped, you know, wherever.
Can you tell me a little bit more about your time in Zion? Any recollections of interesting stories there?
Well, I used to go to the naturalists' presentations every night, and I don't know when it was, but it wasn't too long that it got to the point to where I could have given the presentations as well as the naturalists, because I knew what they were going to say. I also knew that I knew the territory as well as any of them, and better than some of the the newer ones, because I had, I had hiked all over there. One of the guys that I really had a lot of respect for was the chief naturalist. Now, I don't remember his name, but he kind of took Phil Bruick, and that's Bruck, who was the son of the assistant superintendent at Zion. Phil and I were about the same age, but he took Phil and I kind of under his arm and would take us in places that weren't open to the public, to where we could actually get in and see some see some of the previous civilizations that actually had lived in Zion. So he really started my real interest in archaeology. Well, not so much archaeology as much as anthropology, because I would, I was more into, how did they live, where did they, where did they come from, where did they go, So I think that's really where I got my first real interest in anthropology, and ended up with an anthropology minor in college.
Nice. Did you hike the Narrows?
Oh yeah. Yeah, we actually Phil had a he had a problem with one of his feet, so he didn't hike as much as I did. There were twins, Dan and Don Dennett, Dennett. They were the sons of the, I think he was the supervisor of maintenance for the park. And Dan and Don and I actually hiked all the way through the Narrows up to the headwaters of the Virgin River. That takes about a week to make that hike. Of course, there was no place to camp in the Narrows because it was kind of wet. But that was really kind of a neat trip. And then we got picked up by I can't remember whether it was my folks or it was Wes Dennett that picked us up. We did get picked up to come back. We didn't have to hike back down the Narrows, or we didn't have to hike around, because it was a good long trip. And the thing that was really enjoyable about that trip was just the fact that we were doing something that very few people ever did. And most people would get to the point in the Narrows where it was at its narrowest point, and they would turn around and go back. And we'd done that I don't know how many times, so we decided to go ahead and go on through and just see how far it was. And it got pretty tough. Probably the last 2 days, the hiking got a little tough, because we had some pretty pretty steep inclines that we had to go up.
Had you seen signs that other people had done that? Were there cairns, little piles of stones, or were there trailing?
No, nothing like that. As a matter of fact, a lot of times, And you know, a lot of the rangers and the naturalists would tell us if we saw anything like that in the park to take it down. You know, because basically, the whole concept of take nothing but pictures, leave nothing but footprints, was something that was just really impressed upon us, and I because of that have carried that into my adult life. It galls me when I see anything where I don't care whether it's in a national park, I don't care if it's in public lands, where a rock face has been defaced, or names have been carved in a tree or something like that. That bugs me. I consider myself, a lover of nature and a conservationist, so I just, to me, that's just not acceptable. And I think, and getting back to the conservationist part of it, Flagstaff used to be full of true conservationists. We were mostly hunters. What really gets me is some of the, the organizations like the Sierra Club and some of those who, you can't kill the deer, you can't kill the elk. The herds have to be fed. And probably the most conservation conscious people that I know are hunters. Because the whole thing is, we're not going to go out there and kill off the herd because we want to go out next season. But the thing about it is in parts of Arizona, especially places like the White Mountains, the elk have gotten to the point to where they've overgrown, and it's very sad to go out. Even around here in Flagstaff, you'll see it too. But in most of the mountain area in Arizona, to go out and see, elk and deer who have died, obviously of starvation. Because the forest just will not handle the numbers that we have. And, it needs, we need to really look at it, and Game and Fish needs to be increasing some of the, some of the tags, so that we can actually do a better job of, of managing the herds, rather than,
So I wanted to go back for a minute to, as a child interested in anthropology, did you collect arrowheads and pottery and those types of things?
Not really.
Okay.
Because, I mean, in Zion, no.
Right.
Around here, mostly what we did when we went, we went camping basically just to get away. And we weren't, we weren't going to look for arrowheads or anything like that.
Well, the reason I'm asking is because I'm thinking you're going to do this river trip in Glen Canyon, which is sort of an archaeological survey trip. And there's going to be a lot of looking at ancestral Puebloan ruins and sort of things. And so I'm thinking, any other trips that you might have done before that Glen trip that sort of, just like Zion, fueled your interest in the Native American times here before European contact?
Well, being raised in Flagstaff, you know, we've got the, you know, the Navajos and the Hopis, and you know, with my granddad's saddle shop, you know, we did business also with the Supai, you know, with you know, some of the Apache tribes, not many, but we did business with a lot of the Indian tribes, and so I was, you know, I was very familiar with those. Mm-hmm. Working for my granddad were Ruben and Louise Lomaesfa, and don't ask me how to spell that one. I believe it's Lomaesfa.
Or TWA?
Could be TWA, yeah. Okay. I'm not sure how to spell that one at all.
So they work for your grandfather?
They work for my granddad, and they had a son, Reuben Jr., who was a year or two older than I was. And so, you know, I also had, I guess I was probably 10 or 12, and I actually got to spend a week out of Second Mesa with Louise's folks. And Reuben was cruel. He, you know, the Kachinas were coming in, and I believe it was, I believe it was the corn dance that they were coming in for. And Reuben says, oh, you've got to go out and see this. Well, ahead of the Kachinas were the Kachinas that were whipping the kids that weren't inside. yeah, so, you know, I did get a couple of lashes from a Kachina. And
he set you up for that.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, you know, Louise's family, you know, lived very traditionally there on Second Mesa. And so that, you know, that probably started more of anything of my interest in anthropology, because I actually got to live it. You know, whereas before I was just observing. At that time, I did get to actually, you know, ate the food, you know, followed their customs, you know, and, you know, like I said, you know, were there for, you know, was there for the, you know, for at least one Kachina entrance into the village, which, you know, was very impressive, especially getting whipped. but you know, my dad, you know, was very interested in, of course, the education of the Hopi Indian child. He actually wrote his master's thesis on the education of the Hopi Indian child.
What's your father's name and your grandfather's name?
My grandfather's name was Doc Williams. Actually, it was Emmett. Emmett Guy, and my dad's name was James Randolph. Now, so I've got my granddad's middle name and my dad's middle name.
And your mother's name?
My mother's name was Renee.
So I get the idea. Zion, hiking a lot, interested in Puebloan culture, certainly spending time in Hopi helped that. How was it that this Glen Canyon trip, how did you hear about it? How did you end up getting on it?
I'm not real sure, but I do know that my granddad used to make a lot of stuff for the River Runners. Yeah, because they did use a lot of leather things. That was before, you know, nylon and everything was, you know, was real you know, was popular, or, you know, some stuff was not even available in nylon. And I think possibly there, or possibly the Museum of Northern Arizona. My granddad was also a rock hound, and so he worked a lot with the, you know, with the geologists out at the museum. And, you know, of course, he and my dad had collected Kachinas, and so, you know, he was very familiar with the, you know, with the curator of the, you know, of the Hopi collection. You know, he was, you know, he had his fingers in a lot of pots, you know, and so I'm not sure exactly how, you know, I came to meet Gene, whether it was in the shop, whether it was at the museum, but, you know, she asked, you know, she asked if I would like to go on, you know, on the river trip, and a friend of mine, Clifford, he and I, you know, we did a lot of camping and hiking and so forth together around here.
Do you remember Clifford's last name?
I have, no, I don't.
Okay. And also, was that the first time you'd met Gene Foster?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any first impressions? Any thoughts?
She was a very interesting woman. She, before we actually went on the trip, she had us, you know, to her house, and was showing us, you know, pictures and artifacts that she had collected. I mean, she had, her house was like a museum. It really was. I mean, it was just phenomenal. She actually, you know, she actually, you know, kind of got us started on what we were to look for, what we were going to see, and so forth. And I don't think, you know, we kind of thought that, well, now we've got this responsibility, we've got to look for this or look for that. But I don't think that was the, you know, that was her full purpose. I think her intent was to get us to just make sure that when we were on the trip, we were looking. You know, but we felt like, oh, well, you know, we're really important here. We've got to make sure we see this or we see that. And, you know, so the trip, with the trip, we actually started at Lee's Ferry.
This was 1960, 59? 59, 60-ish. What do you remember about Lee's Ferry at that time?
It was a jumping off place for the, you know, for any river trip. You know, it, it was almost commercial in the way it looked, because, I mean, all of the, you know, all of the commercial river runners and so forth, that's where they started. You know, they started the trips there. And so, you know, it was very well developed for, a putting the boats in the water and putting the rafts in the water. You know, I assume that it had gotten that way because of the popularity of the river trips. You know, the river trips that were actually starting to get very popular, probably around the mid to late 50s. You know, people really started, you know, doing it. Especially when they started talking about, you know, Glen Canyon Dam and putting in the dam, because then there was the interest in Powell, and what he had done in terms of going down the river and running the rapids and so forth. And so I think that really spurred a lot of the interest, because prior to them starting to even talk about the dam, nobody ever heard of Powell. Some guy that was around Arizona, don't know what he did, but then all of a sudden now they're talking about the dam, and they're talking about, well, now what is this going to do to the river? How is it going to affect the river? It has had, as I see it, it's had both positive and negative effect. From a positive standpoint, it tends to, be more controlled. From a negative standpoint, it has basically warmed up some of the some of the areas in the river, especially around Jackass Canyon, where now it's kind of a hike to get down there, but there's a lot of freshwater shrimp, and the trout get to be huge, in that particular area, and that's kind of a negative because it's not natural, trout generally are not much more than a huge trout 18 inches, people are pulling out, 5, 6, 7, 8 pound trout out of there. And, they're running, 24, 36 inches. It's kind of affecting the ecology to a certain extent. So, like I say, it has, it's positive and negative.
So, it's 1960, 59, 60, the trip started at Lee's Ferry.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you go from there? How did it work?
Well, we went down the Colorado, and the first place that I really remember impressing me was at the convergence of the Colorado and the San Juan.
Okay, so hang on a second. I'm going to back up because I'm kind of confused. Lee's Ferry is downstream of Glen Canyon Dam. Were you thinking of Height and Height Ferry, or Hall's Crossing, Dandy Crossing, back up there? Did I goof this up?
No. No, because Lee's Ferry was the jumping off spot.
So you,
even before
you,
the dam.
Are you motoring upriver?
Yeah.
Okay, I goofed that. I figured you would be floating down. So in 59, the dam was under construction, and they were going to turn off all river traffic, and people were going to come in and out at Cane Creek, and that must have been pretty close to when that was going to happen.
Actually, the commercial trips at that time were coming out of Cane Creek.
Okay.
But this was, this was a trip that was sanctioned by the Park Service.
Ah.
So we were able to do a little bit different trip than what the commercial trips were doing.
Thank you.
The Park Service actually had, and I'm not sure whether they partially funded or...
Do you think it was Bureau of Reclamation?
It could have been.
Because I'm not sure that the Glen Canyon National Recreation Area had even been established yet.
It hadn't.
So I bet if it was Reclamation, then they would have given you the green light past the dam upriver and wherever you wanted to go.
Well, the thing was it something that kept popping up was what was that? I can't remember it now. It was the 66. that the that what was the Utah parks, which was North Rim, Zion, Bryce, Cedar Breaks, Project 66. What was the name of that project? But it was all to be completed, all a bunch of stuff to be completed by
It could have
66.
been at Mission
And
66.
Mission 66, that's right. Was that what it was?
Yep.
Mission 66, okay. So it could very well have been the Park Service under the auspices of Mission 66 because of the fact that they were looking at, expanding. And they did know that, that because of the dam and because of, the lake that was going to be there, that, there were certain areas which had been pretty difficult to get to, like Rainbow Bridge, would now be readily accessible. And so I think they were, I think that was part of this whole project. I mean, that wasn't the focus of the mission, but I think that was one of the things that they were really looking at is how do we save this? If we make it so accessible, which it is now, well, not so much now because the lake's down a little bit, but when the lake was, when the lake was up, I mean, it was nothing to go to Rainbow Bridge. And it was an easy hike, but before the lake, it took some effort to get to Rainbow Bridge. So I think, so I think that that's why I think it was more the Park Service than the Bureau of Reclamation.
What do you remember then about the dam as you're down on the river going upstream? What did it?
Well, we could see, we could see the catwalk going across. We could see, we could see the construction on either side. They really hadn't started down in, in the water yet.
To build the diversion tunnels and
Right.
make the
Yeah,
cofferdam.
they were basically, they were basically at that time, I believe they were still working on the diversion tunnels. But I wasn't paying too much attention to that really because I was looking, looking forward to what we were going to see later on. And like I say, I mean, the dam didn't, wasn't really, an impression, or the skeletal start of the dam wasn't really an impression because I was really looking forward to, to getting to some of the ruins and some of the hieroglyphics and so forth that farther down the trip.
How many boats? What kind of boats? How many people?
We had, there were five boats. There were probably 15, maybe 20 people.
Wow.
But actually one boat was nothing but, gear. And it was all it had was a pilot in it and that was it. But the other four boats, I think we had like three or four people in each of the boats.
Were they rubber? Were they metal? How big were the motors? Do you remember any of that?
I don't remember how big the motors were, but the boat with the gear in it was metal. We had, they were almost like pontoons that we were riding in. And primarily, I think, because of the fact that, there were some of the rapids we had to carry the things over.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Well,
Because
we.
they weren't powerful enough to climb to motor up them.
No, it wasn't so much that as much as the fact that, this wasn't a whitewater trip.
Right.
It was a, it was more of an educational trip, and consequently, we weren't trying to run Class 5 and Class 6 rapids.
Sure.
So we would, instead of even going through those or even attempting those, we just carry the boats around.
Okay.
Yeah, so, and I think that was more for safety than anything else, because we didn't have the whitewater crews with us, you know.
And there's a lot of boats in Glen Canyon at the time were the little 10-man rubber boats with a little transom in the back. So it was sort of a rubber thwarts connecting the sides and then all your stuff in there. These, you just throw that stuff out and four people, five people would pick that thing up and just carry it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they weren't the big boats.
Right.
Yeah, they were by no means, you know, the boats that, you know, you see now that, you know, that are going on the, you know, the rafting trips where they're running rapids and so forth, where the things are huge.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
These were small enough that, you know, two or three people could carry them.
Got it. Do you remember the month that you were there?
It was probably May or June. Late May or early June.
So that's kind of right at the peak runoff time.
Yeah.
Did you see driftwood going by?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Wow. And it was very, very definite. The statement of the Colorado River is too thick to drink and too thin to plow. I mean, it was dirty.
Do you remember who else was on that trip?
No.
Okay.
I really don't remember names. Because most of the time it was just Clifford, Gene, and I would, you know, we kind of stayed together. And I, you know, there were some, I, you know, some students on the trip. You know, I don't know, you know, I don't know how they were selected or what, but, they, you know, they kind of, they were kind of in their own group, and but you know, because Gene was really good with Clifford, you know, because she would, you know, when we'd see something, you know, we said, "Oh, what's that?" And so she would, you know, she'd take the time to explain what it was and what it meant. And you know, especially when we got to the San Juan and went up the San Juan, I mean, where we're seeing, you know, we're seeing actual, you know, evidence of habitation. We're seeing petroglyphs. We're seeing hydroglyphs. You know, all of these things, and you know, and. Now I probably couldn't tell you the difference between a petroglyph and, you know, a hydroglyph, but at that time, I mean, Gene would explain to us, you know, oh well, this is because, and also the, you know, the civilizations, you know, there were, I guess, two or three different civilizations that actually inhabited at one time or another the canyon. And you know, so she would tell us, okay, this was, you know, this was such and such, and they were here from such and such to such and such, and these were here from such and such to such and such, you know. So you know, and you know, I mean, just to look at the, you know, the ruins of the dwellings, unless you had knowledge that, you know, that she had, you wouldn't see any real difference. I mean, there wasn't a whole lot of difference, but when she would point out, okay, because of this, you can tell this. Oh, okay. And so you could really see it. And so it was, I mean, I the most impressive part of that trip was the San Juan. And you know, being able to see, you know, the evidence of life in the canyon, and being able to actually be where, you know, people had not really been in a long, long time. And, you know, I find it unfortunate now that people are actually starting to hike into the San Juan. Because, you know, there's always that danger of somebody wanting to put their name on the wall or something like that. And, you know, those are hieroglyphics I would rather not see.
As you guys were going upstream, were there river trips coming downstream? I guess that would have been above Cane Creek that you'd have run into those trips coming down.
Yeah.
You saw them. Did you guys hike up to Rainbow Bridge?
Not that particular time, but I have hiked up to Rainbow Bridge.
From the river or from coming in?
From the river.
So that means there's more river trips than one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Great. I want to hear about those, too.
Well, those were just fishing trips, really.
And did you start those at Lee's then and go up?
No.
Or did you come down from
those,
above?
Yeah, those we came up from above.
Where did you come down the San Juan Arm or come down the main Glen
No,
arm?
Come down the main arm. Yeah.
Out to height? And come in there. Was that the same time period, 59, 60? Or?
No, it was later.
Later.
It was later.
Okay. Yeah.
And actually, it was even after the dam, too. I did get to go up to Rainbow Bridge twice before the lake. And then I've been up to Rainbow Bridge just one time since the lake.
Mm. There was a register at the bottom of the bridge, a big book. Did you sign that?
No.
Okay. Because I was just wondering. It's all been digitized, and so I could look. If you've been there in 59, we could pull up 59 and look to see it in there. But, yeah.
Okay. No, no, that wasn't important.
Right? Right.
We were kids. You know, it's just the fact that, we actually went up to go fishing, and, both times... before the dam, we actually just went up to go fishing, and then decided to hike up to Rainbow Bridge.
Hmm.
It wasn't something that we went up there primarily because we knew it was there and we wanted to see it the first time. The second time. The second time that I went there, there was somebody else that was with us in the group that hadn't been there, and so we went up to show them. It was really kind of sad that they made Rainbow Bridge so accessible, because of the lake. And a lot of stuff that, that is accessible now that wasn't readily accessible before.
So let's go back to the trip. I find it brilliant. It's excellent thinking. If you're based out of Flagstaff, you drive to Lee's Ferry and you go up the river. Instead of having to run a shuttle, you end up where you started and you load up the boats and you go home. So that's a brilliant bit of thinking. And with motorboats there, the access across the river, upstream, downstream, would have been far greater than with a muscle powered bore boat.
Yeah.
And by 1959-60, I would assume that this was Gene's, I don't know, 15th, 20th trip down there, some rather large number, but she had figured out where she needed to go that she hadn't looked at enough, or that was richer than some of the other areas, archaeologically speaking, that she wanted to go to. So where did you go and what did you see?
Well, like I say, the most impressive part of it, and the thing that I remember the most, is San Juan.
Mm.
Yeah.
Did you go all the way up to a place called Zahn's Camp?
Yeah.
Okay.
All the way up as far as we could actually get the boats to go.
How far was that, do you remember? To get to Paiute Farms?
Yeah, just about Paiute Farms was about it.
Wow, that's quite a ways.
And, that's why that part of the trip was so impressive. The rest of the trip, you know, there was a little here, a little there, but, you know, nothing to that I really remember that sticks out in my mind. But, you know, all the way up to Paiute Farms, I mean, it's just one thing after another. I mean, it just, you know, oh, well, there's this, and then there's this, and then there's this. And, you know, and I mean, it just, the, you know, the rock formations, the, you know, the, just the, you know, the grandeur of the, of that canyon, you know, it's just, it's unbelievable. I think, you know, going up the San Juan, that canyon is more impressive than the Grand Canyon of the Colorado.
Wow.
You know, I mean, it's just, it's a little tighter, but it just, you know, the difference in the, in the rock formations, the, you know, the strata, I mean, you can actually see the, you know, the carving of this, you know, of this beautiful structure, you know, much better in San Juan than you can, you know, in the Grand Canyon. You know, I mean, you know, it's okay. It's nice to go, you know, down to Phantom Ranch and cross over, you know, across the river and see what's over there, but nothing like the San Juan. You know, and I've done a couple of trans canyons north to south. I've never been brave enough to go south to north. Why go up higher when you can just go up?
Smart people. Yeah, the smart people go up.
But, you know, nothing to the point of what, you know, what that trip was up to San Juan.
What were some of the neatest things that you found or that you saw on that trip?
I think probably the neatest things were some of the petroglyphs. And Gene would tell us what they said. And the various hunts, you know, and I don't know how she knew, but, you know, she'd say, okay, well, this hunt came first and this hunt came after that, and, you know, and this was another season, and, you know, so, I mean, she could distinguish between a spring hunt, a fall hunt.
Were they big panels or were they small?
Most
types?
Of them were pretty small.
Okay.
Most of them were pretty small.
Huh.
And, you know, the hieroglyphs that were in the larger panels, they were much more modern than, you know, some of the petroglyphs. And so I kind of zeroed in on the petroglyphs more than I did the hieroglyphics.
Nice. Camping out, I'm assuming driftwood fires. The water was up, so you guys might have been up in the tamarisks there. Do you hike up out up on the slick rock,
yeah,
top land?
Quite a bit.
Okay.
Yeah, several times. We went up, probably an elevation gain of 500-700 feet.
So right up on top then.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice.
And as you're going up, you know, to get so close to where you're seeing the carving, you know, the striations and how that little river created this huge, you know, area. You know, I mean, just a phenomenal, you know, just to realize just, you know, what that took. You know,
did you spend a lot of time on the right side of the San Juan? There's a triangular wedge of land that gets ever smaller that's between the main stem of the Colorado and the San Juan, around the Great Bend there, down to Zahn's camp. That was hard to access, and I'm curious to know if there was lots of habitation on both sides of the river, or was it more on the south side than the
more
north
on
side?
The south side.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, because of that, you know, that was almost a delta. And, you know, so you couldn't depend on it from, according to Gene, you said you couldn't depend on it from time to time that you went down. As to whether it was, you could have a good camp on it, or if the camp had to be really small. She was saying that particular, that particular area was one that, and when we were there, I mean, like you say, the water was up, and so it was tiny. It really was small.
How did you work out your drinking water?
Well, we did a lot of drinking right out of the river. We take it out and let it settle, and then we'd boil it.
You did?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, this is before we had the water purification systems that backpackers have now.
There were a number of springs that would have had just regular drinking water.
Oh, yeah. We had those, too. But, I mean, a lot of times we had to just drink river water.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And like I say, because we didn't have the water purification systems that that are available now, we did boil.
And that was common practice for many decades to do that. Of course, it was tough because it was hot in the summertime, and your water's there ready to drink, except it's boiling and it would cool down.
Well, we had, we take the military canteens, we'd actually tie those, fill those up with the water after it was boiled, and we'd actually throw those into the river
to cool them off. Great.
Yeah.
Did you go swimming in the river? Were
oh
you
yeah,
a good swimmer.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a life jacket or just
no.
jump in?
Life jacket? Come on. Look what we're talking. We're talking 59-60.
They were around. Nobody wore them.
Well, they weren't required.
Yeah. Well, there's that.
Yeah.
That's true.
We did have life jackets on the boats, as I recall, but I don't think we ever wore them.
What else do you remember about that trip?
The food was great. We fished, so we did have a lot of, fish. Unfortunately,
Guy, hang on right there. What kind of fish were you fishing for? It wasn't trout.
No.
What were you getting?
I don't know.
Chub, humpback chub,
probably.
Suckers, I mean the Colorado squawfish, I'm just curious to know, because there would have been some big fish in there.
We did get quite a few suckers, but then we had fish I'd never seen before.
Carp and catfish would have been in there as well.
We didn't catch any catfish.
Okay.
But, we caught some carp, but then besides the suckers and the carp, there were a couple other species of fish that I have no idea what they were. They were probably 16, 18 inches.
Okay.
They weren't as bony as the carp. They tasted kind of, well, all of them tasted kind of muddy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, so we had a lot of fish. We had, of course, jerky. I think One night we had a Clifford and I were cooking that night, and so we took probably 2 pounds, 3 pounds of jerky, rehydrated it, and we made a soup. And we actually used greens that we collected from around there.
The mustard greens kind of thing?
Some mustard greens, some clover.
Okay.
Watercress.
Wow, all right.
All I have to say is thank God for my time at Zion with the naturalists, because I knew which plants that we should eat and which ones we shouldn't.
Nice.
And we made this soup out of jerky, and we had a dandelion salad, and what else is this? I can't remember. When we cooked, we generally did the same thing. And we cooked about probably every 4 or 5 nights.
So this was a teams, different teams would cook?
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm assuming lots of canned goods.
Most of the vegetables that we have had were canned goods. We did have some canned meats.
Mm-hmm.
We had, of course, Spam. That was a kind of a staple. We had, the unfortunate thing was we didn't have, the freeze-dried foods that we have now that are so good, they were kind of, the first night we did the jerky soup, people were just, they couldn't believe it, we'd taken this jerky and actually made soup with it, and the jerky was actually, easy to chew.
Yeah.
You didn't have to tear it apart, it actually was chewable.
And with the greens, it would have made good eating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How many days was the trip out totaled?
It was about 3 weeks.
Okay. For quite a while.
We were out quite a while. Yeah.
Did you go back to resupply, or were you self-contained? You had all your food for 3 weeks.
Somebody went back to get more food. I do know that.
Okay.
And that was the the pilot that was running the supply boat.
That wouldn't have been a fellow named Frank Wright.
I have no idea.
Okay.
He never was really around us much.
Okay.
He pretty much kept to himself.
Wore a cowboy hat?
Yeah.
Older gentleman in his maybe 50s or so?
Now, keep in mind, now I was just a teenager, so older was a...
Everybody was older.
Everybody was older.
Yeah.
Maybe
Gene's age-ish around there.
No, he wasn't quite as old as Gene.
Okay. Could have been another
people. I really don't know. It was kind of funny because, most of us were wearing, like hiking boots and so forth. He was wearing cowboy boots. And why he was doing that, I don't know. But, that's what he wanted to wear. Mm-hmm. Of course, he never went, when we'd go up on the, up on the ledges and so forth, he wouldn't go. Mm-hmm. He'd just stick by camp.
Okay. So you've seen Glen Canyon before Lake Powell and after Lake Powell. And you've already mentioned there are pros and cons of the whole system. Are you glad the dam is there?
I can't say that I am. And I think that's the reason I say that is probably because of the accessibility of some of the sites that should not be easily accessed, like Rainbow Bridge. Yeah, I just think that, you know, that unfortunately in our society today, there are people who don't appreciate, you know, the grandeur that, you know, that God gave us. You know, they think, oh, well, that's, you know, this is my country, this is mine, rather than realizing that it is everybody's. Yeah, and I think that, you know, that's the one thing that I do object to the dam being there.
Was it scenery, scenic? I mean, most of the people I asked that question, they're like, oh my gosh, it was incredibly scenic, it was paradise and that sort of stuff. And the reservoir is a completely different type of experience, journey. You're not sort of saying that. You're saying, no, the reservoirs brought a level of accessibility that the rivers didn't.
Right. And, you know, the whole thing is the majesty is gone. Being so accessible, it's not a big deal to, you know, to get to some of those places. And, you know, where if it was tougher to get to, it would be something that I think the people who did make it there would appreciate considerably more. You know, I think that, you know, from, you know, my growing up basically in the Park Service, I have that feeling of leave it alone. You know, don't mess with it. You know, I mean, you know, there's nothing that, you know, there's nothing that man can produce that comes anywhere near what God has given us. You know, I mean, when you look at the Great White Throne in Zion, when you look at Thumb Mountain in Prescott, you look at El Capitan in Yosemite, you look at the minarets, you look at, you know, the Tetons, you look at Devil's Postpile. I mean, all of these beautiful things. Man could never create anything like that. You know, those are things that, you know, that God has given us this gift. And my feeling is let's preserve it. Let's leave it so that future generations can enjoy it as much as we have. And, you know, one thing, you know, since I've retired, the one thing that I'm going, you know, that I intend to do is I'm going to revisit all of these national parks that I visited as a kid, as a teenager, because I know that looking through adult eyes, I'm going to see these things considerably differently. You know, it's one of the reasons I've got my pop-up out there is I intend to do that. And I mean, next summer I've got a friend in Calgary. I intend to go up to the Stampede. He's very active in the Rotary, which does a lot of work with the Stampede. So I'm going to go up to the Stampede. But on my way up, you know, I'm going to be you know, I'm going to be stopping in Yellowstone, in Glacier. I'm going to go over to Banff in Canada. You know, and actually now see these things and see just how much more appreciation I have.
It's interesting thinking about your life here in Flagstaff. When you were here in 1946, the population of the town would have been
about 2,000
folks. And that's a description of the population of the West, going from 2,000 to 70,000, 80,000 that we are today. Huge growth of population. And that's put a lot of stress on the parks and the landscape. So I'll be interested to know your thoughts when you...
You know, I have... let's see. What was it? Dale was 12. So that's 30 years ago. No. Yeah, he was 12. That's 30 years ago. I took him over to Philmont, and on the way back to, at that time I was living in Southern California, on the way back we went through Zion, and it was a little depressing. There were, you know, there were things that had, that were now closed to the public, that had been open. The museum was okay, but it wasn't, you know, it really didn't look at the park, the old park. The lodge in the canyon was so much more commercial than it had been. The grotto had been changed from a campground to a picnic ground. The Temple of Senawawa was unchanged except for the fact that there were so many cars. Because, I mean, I could remember when, you know, you go up there and you, there was no problem finding a parking place. But, you know, I mean, we got up there and we actually couldn't find a parking place. So we couldn't stop.
And, of course, Zion has since implemented the shuttle bus system.
The shuttle bus, which I think is, a good idea, you know, as the Grand Canyon has done as well. I think that's, you know, I think that's a good idea. But for me, I would like to be able to get up there and take my time and not have to rely on some shuttle bus. You know, I'd like to be able to, you know, take my truck up there and be able to park and actually go up into the Narrows. You know, because, I mean, that's, you know, that's a day hike. The Narrows is, I mean, it's a simple day hike. It's not that tough. You know, but with the shuttle bus, you know, well, the shuttle bus, you know, oh, so what time is it going to be here? You know, everything's on a clock. And I just think that's a very poor way to have a national park. Yeah. But the problem is you've got, you know, you've got so many people that are, that are looking at it. I'm kind of wondering, you know, because of some of the, some of the changes, the fires and the introduction of the wolves and so forth into Yellowstone, that's going to be very interesting because I have not seen Yellowstone since I was probably 13, 14 years old. You know, so, you know, that's almost 60 years. Yeah, so I know that that's going to be a huge change. I'm not so interested in, in going into the California parks like Sequoia or Kings Canyon or Yosemite, because my youngest boy was a Boy Scout, we did a lot of camping and backpacking in the Sierras. So I have seen that as an adult. And I'm more interested in seeing the things I didn't see as an adult. Mesa Verde, for instance. When I went out to, down to Tutsuku, I'd seen that as a kid. Big deal. But I really, and that's what really got me going on this. I've got to see these national parks. It was going down there and seeing, now that I appreciated it, what it really was. And I was like, I got to get back and, I got to get back to, the backcountry in Zion. I've seen I've been to the canyon, but I want to get back to the backcountry and see how that is. I mean, hopefully it hasn't, and from what I understand, it hasn't really developed.
That's right, it hasn't.
And so I'm really looking forward to, to getting over to Lava Point, to spending, a week in Zion, and especially in the backcountry. Then getting over to Mesa Verde and seeing that. Arches, when I first saw Arches, it was a national monument. So now to be able to see it, as an adult, I think, I'll be able to appreciate it a lot more.
It's interesting. The reason I was asking you about Glen Canyon, it seems the people who saw Glen Canyon before the completion of the dam and the impoundment behind the dam, you've seen it both ways, and very few people have seen what you've seen, have seen that both ways. So I don't want to miss a chance of asking you about that. And it seems like the majority of the people I talk with, they're in your camp. They're saying the same thing. It was, And of course, population pressures on the land. But Zion, I think, has done a really good job with their preservation efforts and crowd control, which is what it's coming down to.
I think that, that's kind of like, Yosemite Valley has gotten so crowded, so commercial. The only reason I would go to Yosemite Valley would be because it's on the way to Tuolumne Meadows. at least up in the up top, it's not nearly as commercial. I would probably rather go up 395 to get to Yosemite than go up on the other side. But like I say, I've seen Yosemite as an adult. I've gone out to Clouds Rest and from Yosemite, from Tuolumne. My youngest boy and I actually did that in a one-day hike. That's a long one-day hike. Because it's about somewhere between 15, 18 miles for the trip. Once you get out there, it's absolutely phenomenal, but it's a grueling trip.
It's and this kind of goes back to what you were talking about, Rainbow Bridge, is if you got to go 6 miles up from the river, or you got to come overland from the Wilson Ranch or Rainbow Bridge side, or sorry, Napa Mountain side, there's an investment in foot power to get there.
I think that, you know, I think that the people who are willing to make that investment are also the people who appreciate. You know, but when you, you know, going up from the, you know, going up from the lake, you know, it's a little short, little hike. You know, not even a tough hike.
Right. Yeah, that's right there.
And you know, and that's the way, you know. You know, so much of it, you know, so much of it is. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, we used to hike up Riverty Flag, you know, and now, I mean, you know, there's the bike path and, you know, just boom, 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 you know, you know, no problem. You know, it's, you know, I enjoy the bike path. I ride my bike up there, and you know, but I'm not doing it because of, you know, being able to see something. I'm doing it for exercise. You know, but you know, I remember we used to hike up. You know, especially during, you know, some of the special weeks up at the museum, we used to hike up Riverty Flag up to the museum, you know, and it wasn't an easy going hike. It was a relatively, you know, relatively tough hike, you know, and we'd, you know, go up and, you know, we'd have the tiki bread that the Hopis were making, and have the, you know, and look at some of the, you know, some of the basket makers and the pottery makers that were, you know, working up there during the, you know, during the Hopi, you know, the Hopi festival, and watching the basket making and so forth. And, I mean, I've got kachinas, I've got baskets, I've got pots, and I've had those, you know, around me all my life. And so it was kind of fun to watch how they were made. You know, and during the Navajo time, you know, watching how, you know, the weavers were making the rugs and the saddle blankets and so forth. You know, basically, there were, well, let's see, Paul Third, Clifford, Ronnie Fennell. We'd go, you know, we'd make those journeys up there, and then of course when they had the powwow here over at City Park, you know, we'd go over to, of course the carnival was a big draw for kids, but it was a lot of fun to go into the encampments there on Mars Hill, you know, where, you know, and, you know, there were, you know, various different tribes that were, you know, that had their artisans actually working on jewelry or working on baskets, or, you know, not so much pottery, but, you know, because, you know, they had nothing, you know, they had no kilns to do any firing, but, you know, stuff that didn't require extra equipment, you know, to do that, and, you know, and yeah, it was really kind of fun to watch the, you know, watch the Indians when they'd come into town, you know, and here they're, you know, they're in a, you know, in a covered wagon with, you know, with tires on, and you know, we'd go, you know, we'd get up on top of the building that the saddle shop was in, and watch the parade, because the parade used to come down Santa Fe cross over San Francisco, and then back up Aspen, back up to City Park. Mm. And so we get up there and we, you know, watch it. And they're all of the dancers would perform there at Santa Fe and San Francisco.
Nice.
You know, because they would at each of the corners they would, you know, they would do their thing. And so, you know, we're sitting up there watching, you know, watching the things. And when it wasn't raining, of course, at that time, if it was powwow time, it was rain. If it was, you know, if it was county fair time, it was rain. You know, we didn't know what it was like to have a dry 4th of July or a dry Labor Day. Because that's when we had the rain.
So, Guy, we've been at this wonderful journey here for about an hour and a half. Good time to wrap this up. Anything else you remember about that river trip in Glen Canyon that you didn't get a chance to talk about that you want to?
Not really. Like I say, the most impressive part of that trip was San Juan. And having someone with Gene's background and knowledge and communication skills. Mm-hmm. I mean, she was able to, without talking down to us, she was able to really help us see and appreciate what was going on. And I wish that, you know, there was some way that, you know, that my kids could have done something like that. You know, but, you know, it's basically been out of reach, primarily because of the fact that, you know, to plan a river trip now, you have to reserve that, you know, years in advance in order to do it. It's just like riding the mules down to, you know, you can't just go out and say, oh yeah, we're here, I want to go, and go, you know, like it used to be. Now it's, you know, even to get a back country hiking pass, it's tough, you know, I mean, and depending on where you want to go, and I, you know, I wish that wasn't the case, but I can understand, because of the fact that you've got to limit the number of people that are, you know, that are in there, because it's just like, it's like with Flagstaff. You know, we do not have the infrastructure for the population that we've got. You know, and it's, you know, it is, you know, it is sickening to see what, you know, when it takes, you know, in the morning between 7 and 8, 45 minutes to get from here to Home Depot. That's 2 miles. You know, I mean, it's like LA freeways. You know, I mean, and to see, you know, the disregard that the college has for the town. You know, the fact that, you know, Flagstaff used to be a conservative city. And it has now, it rivals Berkeley. And I see that as a I see that as a real shame, because it doesn't, you know, it doesn't take into consideration true conservation. It doesn't take into consideration the, you know, the need to limit the population. Doesn't take into consideration, you know, what is good for Flagstaff. You know, it's too much of the me. You know, and so little, you know, so little of, you know, we've got to, you know, we've got to be able to, you know, allow growth for the individual, not for the city. When the school is going from, when my dad graduated from the college, I think it was like 800 students. and it was a great school because it specialized, you know, they specialized in education, performing arts, forestry. Okay, then they decided that they wanted to be big time and be a university. Well, they almost destroyed the education department. They did destroy the forestry department. The only thing that really has survived is performing arts. You know, I mean, and I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that Eldon Audrey, pure and simple, you know, made it tough to, you know, to go in and do anything about performing arts. So, I mean, you know, that's the one saving grace that I see is the, you know, the community orchestra, you know, that, you know, has grown out of the university. You know, phenomenal orchestra. I kind of wish, like we had in the 90s, where during Christmas they do the Nutcracker. You know, they bring over a ballet from somewhere, you know, generally from Las Vegas. But who did the music? It was the community orchestra. You know, and, you know, doing the Messiah, we had the chorale and the, you know, and the community orchestra. I mean, beautiful cultural events, you know, that, you know, that's the one saving grace of that part of the college. The rest of it, they can throw it away. I call NAU not a university. Yeah, I don't have a whole lot of love for those people over there because when I moved back in 88 from Southern California, I decided to look into getting an MBA, and I went over to talk to them because my problem is math is not my friend, and you know I knew that from talking to MBAs that, you know, a big part of the MBA program was the math. So I went over and I talked to the people in, in the business school, and I said, well, you know, what kind of preparation do I have to make to get get up to speed on the math? Oh, don't worry about the math. No big deal about the math. You know, the big thing you've got to worry about is business law. And I said, you got my transcripts there, right? Yeah. Do you understand what a JD is? Well, yeah. But you need business law. And I said, well, you know, in law school, we call business law malpractice. And I just got up and walked out. There was not a way in the world I was going to go to that school for an MBA. I finally did get my MBA, but I got it through my law school. So, yeah, got an MBA in firm practice, which the only thing I've got is an MBA. I never used dark. Of course, I haven't used my JD either, you know, or my LLM.
What was your career? What did you do?
A pension attorney.
Okay.
And I never really used the degrees, because I did more of the the design and implementation. I didn't do much else other than
I did, for a while, for my mentor, I wrote legal opinions. He's the senior ERISA partner with Jones Day. And he had asked me to write legal opinions. He's now finally retired. But that's basically as close to the practice of law as I've ever been.
Well, Guy Williams, thank you so very, very much for wonderful recollections of Glen Canyon and the San Juan Arm up there.
Well, I enjoyed that walk down memory lane, mm-hmm. Probably if we hadn't, started talking about it yesterday, and I hadn't, seen the book here, I probably wouldn't have remembered as much as I, finally did. Some of the memory joggers and also some of your questions helped me remember other things as well.
Well, good. Yeah. Well, good. Today is the 1st of February, 2018. This is a Grand Canyon oral history interview. My name is Tom Martin, and Guy, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Tom.